Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 169 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel, my co-host. Now, last week we spoke all about Bentley. This week, all about Aston Martin. Andrew has been driving a couple of very significant, and at least one very important new Aston Martin, the DB12. But there's just so much going on around the brand at the moment in Formula One, news of forthcoming models, news of investment in electric powertrains, and investment as well from backers, the likes of Geely and Lawrence Stroll's investment group. So this company, which appeared to be on the brink of disaster not too long ago, now appears to be in far better health. So we discuss all of that. But before we do that, I will just remind you all to rate and review the podcast. And while you're doing it, just hit the follow button or the subscribe button on whichever app you use to listen to this podcast. It really, really helps us, and it means you'd never miss an episode. So thank you for doing that, and enjoy this episode. Andrew, you've spent a few days recently with the fine folk at Aston Martin, particularly on the launch of the DB12. Now, there's loads that we need to discuss in this episode. There are new models, not least the DB12 that you've driven. There's news around the future of the company and its the sort of financial position at the moment. But I just want to try and understand what the mood is like in the Aston Martin camp. I mean, do they seem chipper and optimistic? Because they haven't always.
Yeah, at the moment, they seem really chipper and optimistic. And it's a kind of thing, I've been around this business for long enough to have been here before. You know, I can remember when Uli Betts came in, and I think in about 2000. And this was pre-DB9, but the company was now owned by Ford, and having spent all these decades, you know, with creditors banging at the door, suddenly they had some resource, and suddenly they had at the helm someone who clearly knew what he was doing. And he came in and he stopped the Vanquish, if you remember, because he was so appalled by the quality of the car, and delayed its launch. And that was one moment where suddenly they got themselves a new factory, they've got Ford money paying the bills, they've got a proper industry car guy at the top. And suddenly anything seemed possible. So that was one moment. You know, that all went very sour after quite a long period of time. But, you know, you all remember as well as I how toxic the atmosphere had become by the end of Betts's reign at Aston Martin. And again, this breath of fresh air called Andy Palmer sweeping through the company. They had an awareness. I'm fairly sure this happened. And I can't remember when I was told about it, it was off the record or not, but I'm sure no one will care now. But I think things had got so bad, they had an away day where they all went somewhere. I think all the management went somewhere and basically got to call each other names for a day. They had a clear the air day. which I thought was a brilliant thing to do. And all the old grumbles, all the stuff that had just been sort of rumbling about beneath the surfaces and all the backbiting, and it all just came out. And that kind of reset. And then we had the Andy Palmer era. And there are an awful lot of people who have an awful lot of things to say about Andy, but I think his fundamental ideas were absolutely correct for the company. I think there'll be people who will quibble about the way they were actually implemented. And I think that if anybody wanted to say there was a reason why it didn't go as well as expected, well, there was the whole IPO, which was a disaster. But the plan was good. I mean, so good that basically they're still sticking to it now. Then Tobias Merz came along. Again, you'll hear such a spectrum of opinion about Merz. I know some people who will tell you that he was, you know, he forced some very unpleasant but very necessary medicine down the throat of the company. And others will go, absolutely not. He was a complete and utter disaster for Aston Martin. And of course, it's very difficult on the outside, you know, because we as journalists, we hear both sides of it.
Yeah.
And I have. But certainly now, I think the view with Lawrence Stroll in charge and with Amadeo Felisa running the company, I think there is a view that the grown-ups are back in town. And, you know, whatever you may or may not think of Lawrence Stroll, he understands luxury. He understands that market. He understands what a company needs to do to succeed in that market. And the DB12 is a really interesting car because, you know, although he was like technically around for when the 707, the DBX 707, I think even maybe even the Vantage F1 edition came up, both of which were very well received cars. This is the first car in which he's sort of saying, yeah, this is my car. He wasn't around for the very, very start of it, but its entire sort of development and implementation were done on his watch. And it's a very, very good car. It's a really good car. And I think what I liked most about it was there was, originally, it was going to be a slightly different sort of car. And of course, we don't know what it would have been like had it become what it was originally intended to be, which was essentially a Ferrari Roma rival, a much more hardcore, probably stiffer, less of, more of a, you know, sporting supercar than a traditional Grand Tourer. And the brakes were put on that concept, and it came back. And it basically is today exactly the same car in exactly the same position as the DB11, but just so much better.
Yeah, refined, yeah.
Yeah. Refined and faster, and you know what happened, you know, with a DB11, when you really, really kind of got up it, it all got a bit, it couldn't quite cope. It got a bit sort of, and this doesn't. This is just, it's just broadened the envelope of what it can do. It probably rides as well, but the handling is just of a different order. And it's, and obviously the performance is, it's gone, I think, from like sort of 503 horsepower to 671.
Yeah, huge increase, isn't it? And it's still a 4-litre twin-turbo V8.
Still, it is still that engine. And it's not without its drawbacks. And maybe we'll come to that in a minute when we talk about the car in more detail. But yeah, so you're sorry, long answer to a really quick question. What's the mood like? The mood at the moment is very optimistic.
Good.
Okay. Yeah.
So we will talk about the DB12 in more detail soon because it's a big deal for Aston. But just on sort of where Aston Martin finds itself at the moment, I mean, it really was dragged through. It had a tough time over the past few years, didn't it? Lawrence Stroll has come in with his investment group, and clearly he doesn't want it to fail on his watch. He's got the clout, he's got the expertise, he's got the experience to make something of Aston Martin. And actually, it looks as though now things are quite rosy for the company. So we have a new contributor, don't we? Jim Holder, formerly editorial director at Haymarket. And he's brilliant at the industry stuff. He understands the industry. He gets to talk to all the heavy hitters. And in his first column for us, he wrote about Aston Martin under Lawrence Stroll. So this was a few weeks ago he wrote this. He said that this time last year, Aston was probably and hopefully at rock bottom. So things were really bleak back then. But it's been 12 months and a lot can change in that time. And now Aston's in quite a different position, partly because the Chinese giant, are we saying Geely or Geely? I never really know.
I say Geely, but
yeah, okay.
I'm not quite sure.
Okay, you hear both, don't you? But Geely, so the Chinese giant Geely has increased its stake in the business to 17%. Stroll's investment group has increased its own stake. So they're both putting in a lot of money, buying up a lot of shares. So they're clearly deadly serious about it. Mercedes owns a good chunk as well. And the share price has been rising. Over the last 6-12 months, the share price has been on the up. And it looks as though now Aston has some heavyweight backing from those three. Might it find itself caught in the crossfire in a power struggle as those three battle it out for control? Don't know, maybe. But it does seem as though, for the first time in a while, Aston Martin is not in any great existential peril anymore. And of course, the other big news around Aston Martin at the moment is the management. Not just Stroll, but the CEO and the technical bosses and lots of the chief engineers.
Ex-Ferrari guys.
They're ex-Ferrari guys. So Amedeo Felisa, CEO, the technical director, whose name has just vanished from my
Roberto
mind.
Roberto Fedeli.
Thank you. Okay. I knew you'd have it.
Sorry.
And there are others there as well. Now, the interesting thing here for me is that there's a lot of talk around Aston Martin of a repositioning. And they use this word intensity a lot, don't they? Intensity, full stop, driven, full stop, and all that stuff. And it's what's quite clear is that Aston Martin is trying to become a more exciting, livelier, perhaps more youthful brand. Trying to throw off some of this reputation it's had over the years, a slightly fusty kind of image of older buyers, the Gentleman's Express of walnut and leather and all that stuff. And I'm thinking about it now, traditionally, Aston has probably sat somewhere in the middle between Bentley on the one hand and Ferrari on the
other. Absolutely.
And those two are in very happy places, aren't they? Neither of those are in any great hurry to move. But Aston Martin is trying hard to swing towards Ferrari because being in that middle spot hasn't been working for it. So it's trying to become more exciting.
I see, but I think you have to ask the question, why hasn't it been working? Has it been not been working because the product's in the wrong position? Or has it been not working because the cars just haven't been as good as those of its best rivals? And I think this is probably what lay behind that original decision that I was talking about to make the DB12 a much more Ferrari-like car. And I think it is very significant that they have reversed that. You know, I think it is. You only have to look at Jaguar as an example of a company that really, really came a cropper trying to be like something else, trying to be a BMW. Trying to make a 3 Series. Don't. Mm. I think that Aston Martin, my view is that Aston Martin, I think there is a huge amount of space between a Continental GT and a Roma. And that traditionally, to me, Aston Martin's, and I think one of the things I love most about Aston Martin's, they've never been the fastest car on a straight line or around a circuit. They've never had the best ride quality. And that suggests, I suppose, some might say, well, that shows how compromised they are. But to me, it doesn't. It just shows that they are confident and balanced, exactly, and you know, and comfortable in their own skin. And I'm really glad that I think what they probably mean, what I hope they mean by saying they want to be more like Ferrari, is they want to have Ferrari-like margins. And I guess that probably means charging Ferrari-like money for it. I think that's probably what it means. I mean, look, as another example, at the mid-engine cars.
Now, my
understanding was that, I know this absolutely for a fact because Andy Palmer told me that there was going to be a mid-engine production car. After the Valkyrie and after the Valhalla, there was going to be a mid-engine production car, mainstream production car, and that the whole strategy of doing the Valkyrie, going into Formula One and doing all this was to establish Aston Martin in the mid-engine space so that they had credibility so that when they finally launched the car that really mattered, the production car, the rival to the 296 GTB or the McLaren 720S or whatever they're calling it this week, then it would be credibility and it would be accepted and people wouldn't go, well, hang on a second, what's an Aston Martin doing here? That's not happening anymore.
Yeah, pity. It's been confirmed now, hasn't it?
Yeah, they're mid-engine. They will make mid-engine cars, and I think they'll continue to, but they'll all be limited edition cars. So there'll be Valhalla's
and very, very expensive.
Bazillion pound, what's it, whatever. Yeah. Yeah. And so that, again, suggests to me that Aston Martin is no longer going to try and out-Ferrari Ferrari. And it's music to my ears because they won't do it.
No.
Because people will just go and buy a Ferrari in the same way that, you know, Jaguar discovered that people would just rather have, would just go and rather buy a 320D BMW. And on previous podcasts, we have said about Jaguar that Jaguar has always been at its best when it's leading and not following. And you look back through the history of that company, from the XK120 on up to the I-Pace. That's absolutely the truth about Jaguar. And I think that Aston Martin should have that confidence and a sense of its own identity and go, right, this is us. You know, if you want a car which is much better to drive than a Bentley, but not quite as in your face or ostentatious as a Ferrari, here we are.
Yeah,
and
are.
I think that's a very good place to be. It's also exactly where its brand values are. And I think you abandon that at your peril.
That's right. And yeah, we don't want to see Aston Martin swing all the way to Ferrari because it'll just get steamrolled by Ferrari, and anyone would. But you can see it drawing inspiration from Maranello, shall we say. And the cars that it is producing now... Well, think about the Vantage F1 edition. That's a harder-edged, racier, sportier kind of car.
Great
DBX car. 707, great car. Again, a bit more, well, intense to use their word. So it's clearly trying to move at least a little bit in that direction, because it seems that's what buyers want. That's what, or that it, that's clearly what the management believes, is that buyers want, not, you know, not a bone-rattling ride, but something a bit more sporting, a bit more youthful and exciting than certain Aston Martins of old. And it's it, for the moment, it appears to be working. So the DB12, I mean, are they sort of pitching this thing as a whole new era for Aston Martin? Does it feel like a new start? Are they trying to say that it is? It
doesn't feel like a new start to me at all. They call it the world's first super tourer. I think that's what they call it, ignoring all those wonderful... touring cars that used to race in the 1990s. I think that's one of those phrases that marketing or PR departments come up with to allow lazy journalists to a hook, something to hang their story on, because it kind of just writes itself after that. To me, it is replacement for the DB11, and there's nothing wrong with that. To me, it sits in exactly the same space. It's trying to be exactly the same car as the DB11, but just doing it wildly better.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. It doesn't strike me as being a new beginning at all. I mean, you know, I guess the hoary old cliche would be to say it's always the car the DB11 should have been from the start. Well, it couldn't have been because, you know, Aston Martin didn't have the resources or the technology to do it at the time. Yeah, it's not a new beginning at all. And there's nothing wrong with that.
So it hasn't gone all hardcore, this DB12. Like you said, there were plans for it to be a sort of harder edge model, but it's not at all. It's still a... still a Grand Tourer, even though they call it a Super Tourer.
Yeah,
evidently still a GT.
I had a very difficult introduction to it because I turned up a day and a half late to the launch, thanks to our friends at British Airways.
To a two-day launch, you didn't have long.
I had an afternoon of a two-day launch, and I turned up exhausted because I had to get up 3:30 in the morning twice. And I had, I think I wrote this in my piece, didn't I? I had like 5 hours with the car.
Yeah.
And the Route Napoleon, a Col de Vence. And it did strike me, and I've written about this in the story that's on the Intercooler app and website, that actually that was a really, really good test of a car. Because I couldn't just go and find a corner of a building and curl up and go to sleep. I had to drive it. I had to drive it. So the car had to keep me awake and interested and entertained, but also... It would have driven me scatty if it hadn't, you know, ridden properly and been reasonably refined and that sort of thing. So it was quite unintentionally a fantastic test for that particular car. And it passed it with flying colours, to the extent that by the time I eventually got to the same... It was the same hotel they'd launched the DB9 out of. And I remembered it very well because it was right on the route and it was just a really, really good place to do that from. By the time I got there, I'd forgotten I was tired. That's how good it was.
Mm.
So it was, yeah.
It does sell a lot.
Yeah, and I can remember having, to the extent that, you know, I would go down a certain bit of road, have so much fun, let's just turn around and go back over it again, which is the sort of thing you tend to do if you're got all the time in the world and you're in an amazing sports car and you're just having fun. But I was really, really up against it time-wise. And I was exhausted, and I still found myself doing it. And if the car was good enough to make me do that, then I think it's a pretty good car.
Talk to me about the interior, because it looks like it might be a new age of Aston Martin interiors. They've often been quite ropey, old tech in them, inherited from Volvo or from Mercedes-Benz or whoever.
Yeah, yeah.
Better
it,
now?
It definitely. Oh, yeah, massively better now. I mean, I think the interior will get a very good press and has had a very good press because people compare it to what it was like before. Actually, that says more about how bad the old interior was than how good the new interior. I think the new interior is good. It looks very luxurious. The materials are lovely. I really, really like the fact that you get these strange things called buttons. Remember them? Which make things work. What happens is you press them and they make things work.
Wow.
You don't find yourself just sort of stabbing forlornly at some bit of a touchscreen. So that's, you know, so all that is work. And so I'm not damning with faint praise at all. It's a really good interior. It's a spectacularly good interior for an Aston Martin. Unbelievably, to me at least, they have done their own infotainment system from scratch, in-house. Which is, remember when McLaren tried to do this with the...
Iris,
with the 12C from launch. And eventually they just gave up with it because it was so fraught. And I can remember, I think it was a Ron Dennis decision that they should do it because no one else could possibly do it as well as McLaren. And there were people in the company going, no, you could just get these things off the shelf, please. And he wouldn't have it. And the Aston system is good. It's not great. It's not as good as the Ferrari system, not as good as the system that you get in a Roma. I don't like the shape of the screen, which is letterbox. It's very wide, but not very deep or tall. And I'm someone who always has their navigation on north up. And if you're going north on north up screen, on a very long thin screen, then you don't get to see very much of where it is you're driving. So I'd change the shape better, but it is a good interior. And it is, I think the most important thing to say about it is no longer a reason all by itself to not buy the car. Which I think the old one was, and certainly the previous ones were.
Well, you've been driving another broadly comparable Aston Martin recently, the DBS 770 Ultimate, so clearly the ultimate version of the DBS.
Yeah.
Sort of previous generation, I suppose, if we can delineate the two cars that way. V12, £130,000 more expensive. I just wonder how they sort of compare, you know, which one feels more desirable to you?
If I could have one, for, you know, and money was not a significant factor, so they're both free or both the same price, I'd have the DB12.
Yeah, interesting.
I'd have the DB... Well, because it's just a more usable car. I mean, the DBS 770 is... It's another really good step, and again, it's that old thing of it being the car the original should have been all the time. I remember you and I went to Le Mans in the DBS. Must have been about 4 or 5 years ago. And it's not a car that I've ever been particularly enamoured of. Particularly when the DB11 AMR came out. Do you remember that? The sort of slightly firmer, more precise. I just couldn't understand why people would spend all that extra money on a DBS, particularly because it had such immense traction problems. You couldn't use most of the power most of the time. You remember that. You know, you're just looking at a traction control light all the time. And I just thought it was, you know, a way of charging an awful lot more money for what was a pretty similar car to a DB11. I thought the 770 Ultimate, I was surprised by the lengths that they had gone to, given that this was, you know, let's not be shy about this, a run-out special. But they changed its look and they changed the engine and the transmission and the suspension. I mean, they've been through everything. And they tightened it up, and it was a really, really joyously fun car to have a good trip across country in. But as you and I know, cars are not just about driving, they're about living with too. And I'm a bloke in late middle age. Maybe I would say this says as much about me as it does about the car. But no, I just have a DB12 because point to point, it'll be at least as fast. It'll just be more comfortable. It'll be more refined. It'll work better. It would annoy me less.
It's also £130,000 cheaper. Yeah, but there is something to be said about V12 Astons. So, okay, the Valkyrie's got a V12. I think we can exclude that from this discussion now. Because the DB12, it seems a shame, doesn't it? They've called it DB12, and as it stands, you can't get a 12-cylinder. Will there be one? Or
they say not. And actually, unlike some other manufacturers who say they're not going to do a certain sort of engine in a certain sort of car, I kind of believe these guys, because I think what they've decided, they've said the DB12 will endure, not the DB12, so the 12-cylinder engine will endure, and they haven't said what it's going to be in, but I will bet you all the tea in China that it'll be in the DBS replacement, which we will see within the year, and won't be called DBS. And I think the reason it won't be called DBS is because they're no longer doing the production mid-engine car. So, and this is all speculation on my part. Nobody's told me this, but I'd be surprised if the replacement for the DBS isn't A, called Vanquish, and B, has a V12 in it.
Well, you heard it here first. We'll see, I suppose, don't we? We'll see.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There is also news of a forthcoming very limited edition Aston Martin that we can't talk about, sadly. We'll break the embargo by about 24 hours if we do talk about it now. That's frustrating. I know. You'll have to keep an eye on the Intercooler app and website to see what we're talking about.
So what can we say without getting into enormous amounts of trouble? Because the really annoying thing is you and I know all about this car.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It'll be exciting. I can say that.
Can we say it's got a V name?
You may say that. I couldn't possibly comment, but yes. I think the embargo lists on Wednesday evening, doesn't it? So everybody will know all about it.
It's Tuesday evening.
So it's very, very soon. If you're going to the Festival of Speed, I don't know this actually, but I'm guessing it'll be there this weekend. We wouldn't be talking about it if we didn't think it was worth talking about. We wouldn't be talking about a car we can't talk about unless we thought was a car. So it's not what it isn't. It's not that they've decided to sell the until now Chinese market only straight six version of the DBX in this country. It's not that.
No. Nor is it a sticker set for the Vantage.
No, it's something that if we could talk about it, we'd talk about really quite a lot
in great detail.
Yeah.
That's just annoying for everyone, isn't it?
Oh, well. Yeah, but there you go. But honestly, watch this space, because it looks like fun.
It could be quite cool, couldn't it?
Yeah.
And then the other news this is why we're talking about Aston Martin right now, because there is an awful lot going on, and that's even before we get to Formula One. We'll come on to that in a moment. But there was news last week of its tie-in with Lucid, the EV. Is it still the startup? I don't know, really.
I think it is, yeah.
Very sort of top-endy EV startup, a Californian concern, isn't it? And Aston Martin and Lucid are going to be working together, collaborating on battery electric cars. And Aston Martin has said that working with Lucid, they will produce a portfolio of ultra-luxury, high-performance, electrified Aston Martin hypercars, sports cars, GTs and SUVs. So there's an awful lot coming.
Well, that's everything, isn't it? That's everything they make.
That's the whole lot. That is the whole lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so it's part of a £2 billion investment in technology. And they say, actually, Mercedes will continue to provide Aston Martin with other electronics, with powertrains, engines, combustion engines, and other bits and pieces. So it's not the end of that tie-in. That is a new era, isn't it, for Aston Martin?
Yeah, I don't know enough, frankly, because I haven't gone into it in sufficient detail, which is my mistake, really. But I don't know whether this is sort of like a comparable arrangement to the one that Rimac had with Bugatti and Porsche, and it's now, you know, it's now this quite complicated ownership structure, but whereas basically Rimac's become a sort of integral part of that operation. But it's interesting to see, because I guess if you thought Aston Martin clearly need an EV, everyone needs an EV, you'd think that they would just go and get, you know, Mercedes has spent so much money, haven't they, getting all their EV platforms and that sort of thing, that would be the first port of call, but it hasn't been. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend I really have any understanding at all of why they have gone in such a different direction. But as we said earlier, the people who now run the company are proper grown-ups. This will not be a decision that will have been taken lightly. So I think it's really interesting. And we watch this space with interest. Maybe
the management considered that working with Lucid rather than Mercedes gives them more flexibility, or allows them to achieve exactly what they want.
Yes.
You know, rather than having just hand-me-down componentry, they can do their own thing. Perhaps, I don't know.
It's always the way, isn't it? You know, it is a slightly Faustian pact. I'm not saying this about Mercedes in particular. I think it's whenever any small company goes into a JV with something really, really big. And it's the reason, actually, that Andy Palmer decided not to go and use a Mercedes-Benz platform for the DBX.
Yes.
I mean, it's extraordinary that Aston Martin decided to build a factory and build a brand new platform within that factory to produce a brand new car, because they so didn't want to have to rely on Mercedes-Benz platforms.
So it's got form in doing this, isn't it?
Yeah. Sadly, when Aston Martin has decided to do things on its own, which normally you would have gone to someone else to do when you're that size company, like, you know, make its own engines. You know, the two engines, Aston Martin in its post-war life has designed two engines itself. They both nearly killed the company. So there was the straight six that came in with the DB4 in 1959. And then there was the V8, which was meant to have turned up in about 1965, didn't actually get into a car until the end of that decade. And, you know, that's why ever after Aston Martin has, you know, got engines from somewhere else, and they've adapted them and everything else, but, you know, there hasn't been a homegrown engine in an Aston Martin, you know, a brand new one designed since the 1960s. And there's a very good reason for that. But, yeah, so this Lucid thing is very, very interesting. I mean, what does it allow them to do which they couldn't have done otherwise? I mean, it'll allow them to do massive things. But it's a trade-off, isn't it? You know, do you want to have a completely reliable, probably affordable, clearly very good supply of stuff which isn't yours and you have little control over? Or do you want to become master of your own destiny?
Yeah.
Specify precisely what it is you're going to be getting, but at the same time have to accept that it's going to be a much more uncertain route. And, you know, it'll probably cost you more to do it. Will you be able to charge that much more for the product at the end of it? Maybe, maybe not. But, you know, as you say, Aston Martin, you know, they never shrink away from this, do they? They always go for it. Sometimes it comes back and bites them on the arse, and sometimes it works out.
It speaks to a certain kind of confidence, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Actually, talking of confidence, did you see Autocar reported a couple of weeks ago that Lawrence Stroll has said that he deserves a knighthood for what he's done to save Aston Martin and save all the thousands of jobs that he has done? Now, because it's Autocar reporting, I'm sure it's accurate.
Oh, it will be.
What I don't know is, Stroll could have said that with a wink or with a smirk, you know, and then that totally changes the meaning. However, it is hard to imagine him saying something with a wink and a smirk, isn't it?
No, it's not, actually. I can hear him saying it.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I sat down with him a couple of times, and I think sometimes he does say things, in a sort of certain slightly knowing way, because I think he knows how he is perceived, and yeah. I think he plays up to that a bit. I can hear him saying it and wishing to be taken not entirely literally, but maybe he did. I don't know, I wasn't there.
Perhaps he genuinely thinks he deserves a knighthood. Well, maybe he will eventually. Okay, so we do need to talk. You can't discuss Aston Martin in 2023 without talking about Formula One, can you?
Yeah.
Because it's been one of the stories of the year.
Yeah.
They've been scoring podiums, almost challenging for wins. Not quite. That Red Bull is so fast, but Fernando's been certainly best of the rest on a few occasions. However, you know, we've just had the British Grand Prix.
Yeah.
And Lance Stroll was nowhere. Fernando Alonso finished seventh, having not qualified terribly well either. And, of course, what's happening is that other teams, certainly McLaren, have come flying through the pack. And last week, yesterday at least, that was the fastest car other than the Red Bull, wasn't it? So is that what we're going to see now, do you think? Are the others, are Mercedes and Ferrari and McLaren, getting their act together? And are they going to displace Aston Martin? What's your instinct? Or do you think Aston Martin can come back swinging in the next few races and remain competitive, stay on the podium?
Okay, what I don't understand about this season is, you know, there have been, I think, three big surprises this season. The first one, obviously, was that Mercedes weren't back at the front.
Mm.
The second was that Aston Martin were.
Yeah.
And the third one has been McLaren, which apparently had a complete mutt at the start of this season.
Yeah. You know,
they beat not just the Aston Martins, they beat both Mercedes, they beat both Ferraris.
Mm.
You know, second and third.
And they didn't luck in. No, it wasn't one of those.
Pure pace. No, it wasn't one of those where the weather was a bit dodgy and a few people fell off and, you know, they got lucky with the pit stops or the safety car. Absolutely not. No, they were where they were, second and fourth, sorry. Because Lewis is third. On merit alone, there was a car which, on that circuit, on that weekend, and that circuit is a pretty is a humdinger of a circuit, as you know as well as me, and it's actually got a bit of everything because it's got some pretty slow corners in it. You know, the old the Luffield complex and, you know, the new bit that they built after the wind.
Village.
Yeah, all that, you know. So it's got, and it's got, you know, the Beckett's complex, which I think is the most exciting combination of corners in motor racing. So, you know, they would seem to me to have a car which is, generally speaking, just bloody quick. And I guess it just, what I don't understand is I can't remember another season where cars which, you know, from one minute of nowhere, as in Aston Martin last season, McLaren at the beginning of this season, can come along with, you know, updated car and suddenly leapfrog the entire field. And yet Mercedes comes along, you know, having had a bad start to the season, with its big, right, you know, complete change of philosophy, you know, the whole, you know, side podless philosophy goes out the window, and they come back. And yeah, it's made a difference.
Mm.
But it hasn't stuck them right up the front.
And they've still only qualified sixth and seventh, I think it was, wasn't it?
So. Yeah, so I can't read this season. And you know, and maybe it is all about the scheduling of when the various constructors decide to bring their new bits. But what I'm finding very surprising is that those new bits are making such a difference. You know, I don't know how much time McLaren have found, but it's got to be a second or more, hasn't it, to be able to...
It's huge, isn't it?
It is absolutely massive.
One upgrade... Well, fair play to them.
Yeah.
Is it a flash in the pan, though? We're just going to have to sit back and wait and see, aren't we? But
where do they go
it
next?
Would almost
where,
be...
oh, they go, I think they go to Hungary next, don't they?
Hungary, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, well, that'll be interesting.
It's a very different sort of circuit.
As different a circuit as you can get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I for one, would like to see Aston remain competitive. I think it would be a shame if they genuinely have slipped back as others have moved
too early
forward.
To say. It's too early,
it's too
to,
early
say.
To say.
Yeah.
But they're also ahead of their own... sort of five-year plan, aren't they?
Yeah.
The factory hasn't come on stream yet.
And their wind tunnel.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So they really are building the foundations to establish themselves as a competitive team ongoing.
So Stroll told me, he talked to me about three components. I think one was you know, getting the factory, the other was the wind tunnel, and the third was the staff. And once you've got those, you don't really have an excuse. Then again, you know, we've seen this before. Look at, you know, Toyota at the start of the century. They had absolutely everything.
And couldn't
win a race for love nor money. So, you know, just because you've got it doesn't mean it's going to work for you. But, you know, they are certainly putting themselves in a position whereby, you know, it seems ridiculous to say this now, but you could see in, what, 5-6 years' time, Aston Martin having a run like Mercedes has just had, or like Red Bull has had, or like Ferrari had at the start of the century. You could see it. Of course, because the Formula One team isn't actually Aston Martin, it's just Aston Martin branded, it's Lawrence Stroll's team, essentially. It may not be called Aston Martin by then, who knows?
Okay. So let's say that next year they're even more competitive, okay? It's a tighter pack. Aston, Mercedes have sorted themselves out, Ferrari have sorted themselves out, McLaren is still there, Red Bull still very, very quick. You are Lawrence Stroll.
Yeah.
You're fantastically rich, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Your beloved son has been in the second
Aston
Martin.
Oh, I know what you're going to ask. Go on.
He's been comprehensive. Young Lance, you know, there's no doubt he's a talented driver.
Yeah.
But he's been massively outclassed by Fernando Alonso, who wouldn't be.
Yeah, who wouldn't be, exactly.
But is he now becoming a limiting factor for that team? And would you, as the boss man, have to have a word with your son and say, it's been fun. For the sake of the team, we have to go elsewhere.
I did ask someone at the team. I was lucky enough to go to the Monaco Grand Prix, and I asked someone at Aston Martin that exact question. And I won't say who it was, but he was absolutely certain that Lawrence Stroll would never fire his son.
Gosh.
Which is interesting, isn't it? Because it does sort of slightly fly in the face of this sort of Machiavellian, you know, do what needs to be done approach. And maybe that is his view, but that it has a limit. And, you know, kicking your son out is, you know, is where he draws the line. Yeah, and also, okay, allow me to, this is slightly devil's advocate, but is he any worse than number two at the moment than Perez?
Oh, Perez. That is an interesting question.
You know, could you not, four or five
in a row he's missed Q3 in qualifying?
Yeah, well, Max has been on pole.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, could you not just shape him into, just say to him, look, kiddo, you're doing well. You're clearly, God, this sounds so patronising, doesn't it? Given that he could outdrive me with his eyes shut while fast asleep. But you're not Fernando. And so your job is, you'll still be a Formula One driver, you'll still be an Aston Martin Formula One driver, but your job is to back him up. And we're going to now divert all our attentions to honing you to performing that role. You're going to become the world's best number two. I don't think there's any dishonour in that. I mean, you probably don't like it very much, but I think that is strategically. And I think that he is, you know, if you look at the, when you get an incredible driver, and by which I mean a Lewis or a Fernando or a Max, just because you can't keep up with them, you know, look at Bottas and Lewis, look at Checo and Max. It's a fool's errand, isn't it? Trying to compare and say, oh yes, you know, we're equal number one or whatever, because you're just not. And I think that, I don't think that he is any further behind Alonso than you would expect as someone who could be cast in the role of a perfectly proficient number two driver. And I think that's what will happen, because he won't fire him.
Meanwhile, though, Alonso, what's he, 41 or something?
Yeah.
He does talk about Lance leading the Aston Martin team one day. Now, I think that's a stretch.
That's a stretch. That's not going to happen.
They're going to have to bring in a real hot gun, aren't they?
That's not going to happen, because if Aston Martin Formula One team is to realise Lawrence Stroll's aspirations for it, you can't do that without a top driver.
Yeah.
And I think that with the best will in the world, if Lance Stroll was going to be a top driver, we'd have seen it by now.
Yes.
And so if he leads that team, by definition, they don't have a top driver in the team, and therefore they won't achieve, you know, they won't win championships.
Okay, but perhaps maybe Fernando will do a couple more years, and then maybe Lance is a sort of de facto number one, but they've got a young 21-year-old
who blows the doors off him.
Yeah, perhaps that's what they're lining up. You know, maybe there's an Oscar Piastri coming through or something.
You can call a cat a dog. It doesn't make it a dog, does it? You
know,
you can
say, yeah.
You know, you can say, okay, Lance, you're a number one driver. But if your number two driver's blowing you into the weeds every weekend, you're not a number one driver. That's just what it says in your T-shirt.
But he would be the older, more experienced driver, perhaps the wiser head by then. I don't know, but maybe that's what will ultimately happen. But I agree. I don't think Lance has... he's been racing a while now in F1. I don't think he's demonstrated that he's a Max, Lewis, Charles,
he's not,
Fernando.
But, you know, who is?
No. Just those guys. Okay, all right, let's ask the Martin. Well, there's so much going on around the market at the moment. It's fascinating to see it unfold. And, of course, we'll stay tuned to everything that's going on at Aston Martin.
Yeah.
A couple of things before we go. Goodwood Festival of Speed this coming weekend.
Yes.
We'll both be there.
Yeah.
It's a big one, isn't it? Because it's 75 years of Goodwood Motor Circuit, 30 years of the Festival of Speed. Mm. And there are some other anniversaries being celebrated. Porsche is there celebrating Porsche its own 75 years.
75 years, headline sponsors. So they've got the big display outside the front of the house.
Yeah.
I think they're bringing over half the museum, I think. There's an awful lot of very delicious stuff on its way from Stuttgart to Goodwood right now. So it's if you're going, I mean, yeah, Dan and I will be there. I'm there for the duration. I'll get there Thursday morning. I'll leave at some stage on Sunday. If you happen to see us, come and say hello. It's always good to chat to you guys, find out what you're thinking, try to persuade you to subscribe to the web and website and the app. But you know, just hope that if you are going, you have a cracking weekend. We certainly intend to. I'll be wobbling my way up the hill in a thing or two, undoubtedly. It'll be interesting, won't it? Because, you know, the Festival of Speed is always an amazing spectacle. But because this is 75 years of Goodwood and the 30th anniversary, my goodness, that makes me feel old because I remember the first so clearly. The 30th anniversary of the festival itself. You kind of imagine that the Duke is going to really, really pull out all the stops for this one. Looking forward to it. Can't wait.
So. There'll be a couple of interesting debuts. We're going to see Lamborghini's LMDH Le Mans car.
Yeah.
Lamborghini going racing at Le Mans.
I mean, that's another subject we haven't... We've got lots of time before, because I don't think it's going to be on the grid until... Is it on the grid next year? Probably is if it's an LMDH car. But, Lamborghini goes endurance racing as a works factory team. You know, that hasn't happened before.
No, fascinating. Yeah. Lamborghini doesn't really have a great deal of racing heritage, sort of bits and pieces.
Yeah, I think its greatest racing heritage is on water.
Yeah. You know,
powerboat racing. Obviously there's been a Lamborghini Formula One engine and there have been bits here and there, but nothing really.
No.
But I think from Lamborghini's point of view, it's an absolute... I mean, unlike Porsche, whose LMDH car is not performing as well as it hoped at the moment, Lamborghini, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? Because it's not a very expensive program. And there are no expectations because there's no previous. So why not just go in there? And I think even if you're just out there, and if you manage to, you know, duff up a Porsche or a Ferrari every so often, then so much the better. But, you know, it's not like Porsche and Ferrari where there is this grinding weight of expectations on your shoulders every time you wheel out a new sports car. It's cool.
One of the other things I'm looking forward to seeing is the Caterham Project 5, the EV sports car. I think you've got the photos in front of you. I haven't seen them.
No,
yet,
and also they're all bloody embargoes. I can't talk about that either. I don't care. It looks amazing.
Okay, there you go.
Okay.
Oh, brilliant.
It just looks amazing. I think they've done a bang-up job with it. I can't give you any of the details of the car. I don't know whether I'm breaking an embargo by saying it looks amazing. Am I breaking an embargo by saying it looks amazing?
I don't know. We'll find out
when the letter lands. But it does look amazing. Really looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah, so we'll see that later on this week. Brilliant, can't wait. There are some others as well. It's going to be a busy one. There's an awful lot going on. As Andrew says, if you see us ambling about, come and say hello. I did have a really good listener question ready to go, but it's a It's a great question, and it's going to take a while to discuss it, so we'll leave it for now. We will do it next week, particularly because it's pertinent to a story that is coming up on the TI Appen website very soon. We had a fun day on Friday, didn't we, shooting three Porsche 911s. I'm sure the photos are going to be brilliant. Your story will be excellent, I'm sure. And that, are we going to see it this week, do you think?
My story?
Yeah.
Watch this space. Possibly.
Okay.
Possibly.
Okay.
It's very much a work in progress pile at the moment.
No pressure. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. And hopefully we'll see some of you at Goodwood
over the next few days.
Do. And yeah, tune in next week for another episode.
Cheers.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.